Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin, editor-in-chief at the Mises Institute. Thank you for joining me today. And I would like to talk a little bit about food stamps this time. Now, you may have noticed that unless members of Congress intervene to prevent it, the food stamp program, also known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, will be suspended beginning November 1. If the federal partial shutdown, quote unquote, ends before then, the program will likely send out the usual billions of dollars to the nation's 41 million recipients on schedule. Needless to say, lobbyists and activists who favor the food stamp program have been working furiously to make sure that the program is not interrupted. Much of the narrative around food stamps has focused on the fact that millions of low-income households receive more than $8 billion in food stamps per month in the United States. The narrative is focused on poverty relief generally. The narrative usually works well, given that total spending on food stamps has risen significantly in recent years, with total inflation-adjusted spending up by nearly 100% since 2008, and up by 6% over the past 12 months. While the media narrative is focused on these low-income recipients, it often ignores the role of corporate and industry lobbyists who work to increase food stamp spending and to ensure the program remains permanent. Groups like farmers, big ag, grocery retailers, beverage companies, and other industry players are very active in lobbying members of Congress to ensure that food stamp dollars keep flowing. This should not surprise us when we consider that food stamps subsidize food and drive up demand for the sort of products manufactured and sold by a variety of food-related industries. Consequently, food stamp programs enjoy support from a well-funded alliance of industry lobbyists who work with anti-poverty pressure groups that ceaselessly push for ever larger amounts of tax dollar funds to be spent on food stamps. Now, before we get into the details of how food stamps subsidize food-related industries, let's look first at the present fiscal situation with food stamps. And according to the Treasury Department's report on federal spending for fiscal year 2025, total spending on food stamps, SNAP, was $106 billion for the 12-month period ending September 30th. So even in our post-COVID age of runaway monetary inflation, $106 billion is still what we used to call real money. It's a tenth of a trillion dollars. It's not nothing. So the spending, by the way, doesn't even include other food subsidy programs like WIC and school lunch programs, and it's certainly separate from other welfare programs. In spite of much talk about how the Trump administration is supposedly defunding these programs, they're really not going anywhere. For the calendar year of 2025, the U.S. is on pace to see an increase of $6 to $7 billion over 2024 SNAP spending total of $99.7 billion. This only continues the longer-term upward trend in food stamp spending. Indeed, since the Great Recession, that is 2008, when total SNAP spending was $52 billion, total spending on the program has doubled, and that's measured in inflation-adjusted dollars. The total number of food stamp recipients has only increased, meanwhile, by 47% over the same period. So recipients hasn't even increased as much as total spending, which means that the per capita spending for recipients has gone up. So in 2008, total SNAP spending per recipient was $1,847. By 2024, overall per recipient spending had increased by 30%, rising to $2,393, roughly. So the overall trend continues upward, although the biggest increases occurred during the first Obama administration, during the Biden years, and under Trump's mega spending increases that occurred in 2020. Since 2010, the total percentage of the U.S. population that is on food stamps has not fallen below 12%. It's been at 12%. It even at one point peaked up to above 14% from around 2012 and 2013, and has gone back down a little bit. But prior to 2010, rarely did you ever see the population on food stamps exceed 12%, exceed really 10% of the overall U.S. population. So numbers are certainly elevated now. Now, food stamp use is hardly uniform nationwide, however. We should note that the total percentage of the population receiving food stamps can vary significantly by state or region, really just, of course, obviously just by neighborhood. But measuring state by state, we find that more than 1 in 5 residents of New Mexico, for example, receive food stamps. So that is over 20%. It's 21.2% exactly, according to the most recent SNAP data. On the other hand, on the other end of that is Utah, where fewer than 1 in 20 receive food stamps, meaning that less than 5%. So Utah's at 4.8%. So the worst states for food stamp usage, New Mexico, District of Columbia, of course, if you count that, Louisiana, Oregon, Oklahoma, West Virginia, and Massachusetts, which tends to not be a low-income state, but Massachusetts helps illustrate that states have some say in just how much SNAP benefits are given out to the population. It's they can get waivers, they can get variations from federal policy that requires an approval from the department, but it is something that can be done. And so in a case like Massachusetts, it's probably just they have unusually, quote-unquote, generous food stamp policies. There's only so much that you can change from federal guidelines on that. But states that tend to be in the middle, close to the 12% average, North Carolina, Florida, Georgia, Arizona, Ohio, that's some of the bigger states doing that. But the states that have far fewer people on food stamps, Minnesota, Nebraska, Montana, Idaho, Kansas, New Hampshire, Wyoming, these are often they're usually Midwestern or Western states in many cases. Now, it will be no surprise to many that there are big differences by race and ethnicity as well, right? White people, if we delve into the data, we can see they make up, about 60% of the U.S. population. This is non-Hispanic white people, but they're looking at only about 36.5% of all SNAP recipients. Blacks comprise about 12% of the U.S. population, it looks like. But they're making up 26% of SNAP, so about double the overall population proportion. Hispanics is about the same. It's about 16% of the overall population, about 13% of the SNAP population, and Asians are about 6% of the overall population, 3% of the SNAP population. Now, also, just something I like to mention, because usually people don't mention this stuff at all, is that half of people who on the census call themselves Hispanic also call themselves white, because Hispanic isn't a racial category. It's a ethnicity. So you can check both the box of Hispanic and the box for white, because Hispanic can be any race. You can have Black Hispanics. You could even have Asian Hispanics. It just means you're from Latin America, and you could be it doesn't matter what the racial background is. So if you include the people who call themselves white and are Hispanics, which generally in practice are people who look white, then the white population of the U.S. is really 71%, not this 58% that is usually quoted. So that's 71% of the U.S. population white, and 36% of the SNAP population is included in that as well. So those are just some numbers to be aware of in some differences there from state to state, region to region, and also across different demographic groups. Immigration status can also be a factor here. If we look at the Census Bureau's Survey of Income and Program Participation, the SIPP, we can see that more than a third of immigrant-headed households receive food stamps or some other form of food subsidy, such as WIC. Nearly half of households headed by illegal immigrants receive food stamps. That's from the 2022 SIPP report. The percentage for native-born households, on the other hand, is only 25%. So there's a real difference there as well. But in any case, it's remarkable that 1 in 8 U.S. residents, from whatever their background is, now receive food stamps. And during a period when the official opinion is that the U.S. economy is in excellent shape and in a boom period. This disconnect is due to two fact, two factors. I suspect the first is it become easier to qualify for food stamps over the past 15 years. So aggregated data about the overall economy hides the fact that economic conditions for lower income households are not nearly as good as that of higher income groups also. So combining those two issues, I think that's really paved the way for larger food stamp populations. And in many cases, this is thanks largely to the central bank and its monetary inflation, where we see a K-shaped recovery, as is becoming more popular to mention, where you have wealth that's stagnating for middle and lower income groups while net worth and income has soared due to their participation in the financialized economy. So that creates aggregate numbers that look pretty good, but really for a lot of people, they're more easily qualifying now. Even with the expanded ease in qualification, they're seeing that their incomes are going nowhere fast. And so just more people due to that would qualify for SNAP as well. So let's return to the issue of subsidies, though. So to understand why private industry groups are such big fans of food stamps, it is important to recognize how SNAP spending is a wealth transfer from non-SNAP recipients to both SNAP users and to industry groups. So SNAP funds can be used only on food. It's in a sense like an in-kind sort of subsidy. So when taxpayer dollars are converted into SNAP funds, this takes dollars that could have been spent on anything and channels these funds into food-only purchases. So moreover, empirical evidence shows that SNAP recipients do not treat SNAP funds just as part of their cash that's available. They treat it, the surveys have found that people who use SNAP treat it as a quote-unquote separate mental account. That is, the food is a separate thing that they spend on and doesn't affect what they spend other cash on as much as you might think. So consequently, SNAP spending constitutes extra spending of a sort above and beyond what would have been spent on food without the subsidy. So this leads to rising prices in the food and food services industry because, as one researcher puts it, quote, nutrition programs expand the size of the food and agricultural sector through demand side effects and act to raise agricultural prices, unquote. Other empirical studies have also confirmed that SNAP spending does indeed raise prices and therefore constitutes a wealth transfer to SNAP recipients, but also to food producers and food retailers. Taxpayers and non-SNAP households, of course, are the ones left holding the bag. As a study for the World Bank showed in a June 2022 empirical study on food stamps, the program does indeed benefit SNAP recipients the most, but, quote, increased SNAP benefits also benefit producers at the expense of non-SNAP consumers, unquote. So people who are processing and creating food, they're benefiting at the expense of just people who aren't in the food industry and also don't receive SNAP subsidies. So it is clear that by funneling wealth and spending power into a food-only benefits program, demand for food is artificially inflated, and with rising demand comes rising prices. This functions in a way similar to student loans, which have also led to relentless upward pressure in prices in that sector. So it's easy to see why food-related industry groups would oppose any cuts to the SNAP program. The connection to private industry, however, is nothing new. The food stamp program is now and has always been administered through the Department of Agriculture and not through the usual home of welfare agencies, the Department of Health and Human Services. SNAP is as much a corporate subsidy program as it is a welfare program. Programs similar to the modern food stamp program were founded during the Great Depression to induce low-income households to purchase quote-unquote surplus commodities. You might remember stories about the Great Depression. It's talked about in The Grapes of Wrath, for example, where farmers were destroying food, often at the request of the Department of Agriculture. The idea was to drive up prices. There was this obsession with not letting prices get too low. They hated deflation, still do. It's a certain Keynesian thing that they have a problem with. And so they came up with this idea, though, that rather than destroy the food, we'll subsidize, we'll send out these food stamps so people can purchase that food instead, and that will buoy the overall prices. And this will funnel additional dollars to farmers. So again, we see that this concern is for raising prices, and food stamps were explicitly doing that in the early years. But the program was discontinued after the Second World War when you didn't have as much widespread unemployment. But the idea was reintroduced by the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. As with earlier iterations of the program, the new food stamp program, which continues today, was sold in part as a means of subsidizing farmers and other agriculture sectors. I mean, that was part of the way to get support behind the idea. Moreover, the program was pushed as a component of a so-called war on poverty at that time. Now, ever since, the food stamp program has enjoyed support from special interests and pressure groups that advocate for more federal spending on both low-income households and on food-related industries. In a 2019 article for the MIT Press Reader, Andrew Fisher writes, quote, "Throughout the 1960s and until recent times, food stamps have enjoyed strong support from the agriculture industry, as retailers and processors displaced farmers in capturing an ever greater share of the food dollar, their importance as stakeholders for the program grew. In the 2018 Farm Bill, banks, refrigeration equipment manufacturers, and even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce joined food retailers, beverage companies, and manufacturers as key stakeholders in the SNAP program. These players have evolved into much more important participants in the program than farm groups, as evidenced by the amount of money they spend on lobbying." And Fisher provides a breakdown of some of these lobbying dollars, noting that food retailers, like grocery stores, $53 million spent on lobbying in 2017-2018. Manufacturers, processors of various food products, that's $12 million. The beverage industry, this is we'll see is important, as soda manufacturers, $11.8 million spent on food stamps. Even restaurants get in on it, but it's to the tune of $5 million. Some spending is done by the public interest groups, that is, these poverty relief groups, and that's $43 million. So really just a small fraction of the overall industry spending that's going on here, which totals $171 million. Now, corporate lobbying to protect SNAP spending has been on display in recent years in reaction to efforts to exclude soft drinks and sugary snacks from SNAP programs. For example, in 2018, when the Trump administration tried to limit SNAP spending in this way, a coalition of private sector groups quickly opposed the measure. In an article for the journal Society, the authors describe how a coalition of the American Beverage Association, the ABA, the Food Marketing Institute, the FMI, and the National Grocers Association, the NGA, all launched a lobbying campaign against any restrictions on SNAP spending. To this end, industry groups have long allied themselves with the Food Research Action Center, FRAC, which lobbies for more SNAP spending as an anti-poverty interest group. Industry groups such as the ABA have become substantial funders of FRAC, and this has helped industry lobbyists gain greater access to Democrats, while FRAC has used its ties to corporate lobbyists as a means of influencing Republicans. So if you're an industry group and you want to get in good with the Dems, go to FRAC and they'll go talk to the Dems for you, and then vice versa. So it's a bipartisan program, as one researcher put it. When seeking to influence Congress on SNAP, the beverage industry works through Democrats as well as Republicans, particularly those representing minority districts, unquote. The beverage industry first began appearing on FRAC's list of funders in 2013, and at FRAC's 2014 annual benefit dinner, a number of industry donors were honored, including Coke, Pepsi, and the ABA. FRAC's 2017 annual benefit dinner in Washington, D.C., with 300 guests, acknowledged contributions from PepsiCo, the Coca-Cola Company, the American Beverage Association, and the FMI. So, not surprisingly, recent FRAC materials opposing any restrictions on SNAP spending tend to emphasize the cost to retailers. For example, in October 2025, policy paper, very current, from FRAC states how SNAP restrictions would negatively impact members of the National Grocers Association, the FMI, Food Industry Association, and the National Association of Convenience Stores. Although much of the lobbying is couched in terms of helping poor people, the overall argument made by both FRAC and industry lobbyists is that food retailers should not have to go through the inconvenience of distinguishing between SNAP-compliant foods and non-SNAP-compliant foods. Right? You go up to the cashier and, oh, wow, now they only can take SNAP based on some of the things you buy because it's not all compliant. Now, what FRAC and the food lobbyists don't mention, of course, is that merchants who participate in SNAP already have to do this. Grocery stores already carry a wide variety of products that are not SNAP compliant, including prepared foods, hot food that's served fresh, and non-food items such as flower arrangements and auto parts. So clearly the real purpose of the frack food industry position here is simply to maximize the number of goods that are eligible for SNAP, and thus to increase spending on goods provided by food producers and retailers. Small retailers such as corner stores and bodegas often whine the most about any limits on SNAP spending, stating that merchants cannot absorb the administrative costs of accepting SNAP dollars. Rarely mentioned, of course, is that participation in SNAP is not mandatory. Small retailers, and indeed large retailers too, could simply choose to not participate in SNAP programs and avoid all the hassle of excluding soft drinks and sugary snacks from the purchases of real food. In truth, of course, these retailers want access to the artificially inflated spending levels that come with the food stamp subsidy. This is why retailers so prominently advertise that they accept food stamps. You'll often see these signs on doors at corner stores and grocery stores. We accept EBT, right? We accept the food stamps. They want to get their hands on that sweet, sweet taxpayer money. And so they want to make sure that food stamp users know they can shop there. Now, the motivations of the beverage industry are even more transparent than this. We already know that soft drinks are among the most popular purchases among SNAP recipients. They're popular among the general population, too, but even more popular by a little bit among SNAP users. And so without that SNAP subsidy, though, spending on soft drinks would likely fall substantially, and with it, soft drink prices. So, of course, the beverage manufacturers don't want that to happen. So taxpayers then pay twice in this scenario. They pay the taxes to subsidize food producers, and then the taxpayers also pay higher prices at the grocery store. Consequently, the SNAP program is a way for PepsiCo and the Coca-Cola company, as well as countless other food industry players, to legally rip off the American taxpayer. So it's not just low-income groups that are pushing this. Most of the lobbying money, it seems, is coming from industry players who want to keep food subsidies rolling in. So any proposals for restricting food stamps or cutting spending in the SNAP program is going to face plenty of resistance from lobbyists looking for more corporate welfare. So thank you for listening to this this time on Radio Rothbard. We'll be back next week with more, so we'll see you then.